Chapter 22. London had changed, and not for the better. As he walked along the embankment with Sir Edmund Dixon, Dan saw what Soviet supremacy meant to the nation whose empire had once reached around the world. Houseboats lined the Thames, stretching past Waterloo Bridge and past the bend in the river as far as Dan could see. Grimy, overcrowded houseboats packed with refugees from all those young nations that once had flown the British flag. And refugees from Europe as well. What would Churchill have thought, Dan wondered, if he'd known that 50 years after his death there'd be more than 1 million Germans living in Chelsea and Earl's Court, or that Japanese tourists are the lifeblood of Savile Row? Beggars lined the embankment, most of them sitting on the pavement, silent and blank-faced, empty hats upturned beside them. Too hungry to stay on their feet, Dan thought. They were ragged and scarecrow-thin and filthy. That's what shocked him most. London streets, her buildings, even the grand old embankment itself were thick with collected grime, unswept litter. Graffiti in a dozen different languages were scrawled everywhere, even on the statue of Victoria herself. They've lost it, Dan saw. Heart, nerve, self-respect. Whatever it takes to make a people strong and great, they've lost it. He shuddered inside, knowing that America was sliding down the same grimy chute. Jane can coddle them along for now. They can still tell themselves that everything will work out okay, but the states are going to be like this soon. New York is already this bad. New Orleans is not far behind. It'll get like this all over the states. Sir Edmund apparently was unbothered by the decay. He strolled through the warm autumn morning alongside Dan as they headed for the Houses of Parliament, ignoring the beggars, paying no attention to the teeming houseboats clinging to the embankment's stone wall. The river was gray and oily, but the morning air sparkled clean and fresh. The umbrella that Sir Edmund held tightly rolled in his right hand would not be needed. At least the Soviets sell them all the natural gas they need, Dan thought, no coal fumes ruining the air. Then he realized, of course, that means that Britain isn't in the market for American coal. Score another point for Soviet economic imperialism. Peddler stalls dotted the walkway of the embankment, offering meager selections of fruits, cakes, and an occasional colorful scarf or tie. "Stolen goods, mostly," warned Sir Edmund. "Wouldn't touch them if I were you." He was a slim, slight man in his early 50s with curly, reddish hair that was just beginning to go gray in the pinched, nervous face of a rodent. His teeth were very bad, but the suit he wore was new, expensive, and perfectly tailored. Gray pinstripe with pearl gray vest. Neither Sir Edmund nor Dan noticed the two other men trying to look like casual tourists as they walked along the embankment, a dozen or so yards behind them, threading their way through the strolling pedestrians and squatting beggars and peddler stalls, their eyes never leaving the backs of Dan and the Englishman. They were both dressed in nondescript tweeds. One of the men carried an umbrella, almost identical to Sir Edmund's, except that its tip was needle-sharp. Big Ben tolled the quarter hour, and Dan smiled to himself. Well, there's still that. St. Paul's and Westminster Abbey, and that old Gothic tower with its clock. The stones remain, even though the people get shabby. Sir Edmund checked his wristwatch. Actually, I've got to be at the committee meeting in 3/4 of an hour. I understand, said Dan. I appreciate your taking the time to meet me face to face. Think nothing of it. You've read all the briefs, I presume. Sir Edmund gave Dan a haughty look. Of course. Fascinating business. Did you actually do what the Russians claim you did? Grinning, Dan said, I sent a mission out to an asteroid. They were bringing samples back when the Russians intercepted them and jailed them. They claim they put your crew in temporary custody pending a ruling from the World Court. I know what they claim, Dan said. They further claim that the asteroid material found aboard your spacecraft is legally the responsibility of the International Astronautical Council. Yes, and they claim that a corporation cannot claim ownership of extraterrestrial materials. I know that. Astro Manufacturing doesn't claim ownership of the asteroid or the samples, but we do claim the right to use that material in manufacturing processes. There's nothing in international law that prevents use of extraterrestrial material. Providing the IAC approves. Dan stopped short, forcing the English lawyer to stop also. A dozen paces behind them, the two other men took a sudden interest in the cheap Nepalese jewelry being offered at the nearest peddler's stall. "No," Dan insisted, jabbing with his forefinger against Sir Edmund's lapel. "You don't need IAC approval. The IAC can prohibit your using certain extraterrestrial materials, but only after they have reviewed all the facts of the matter and only after a formal vote by the full council. I've read that law very carefully, Sir Edmund. So have the best lawyers I could find." "It's rather a sticky point," said the Englishman, "I grant you." "The Russians have no right to hold on to that cargo," Dan said firmly. "Possession is 9/10 of the matter, you know." Dan felt a growing exasperation. Sir Edmund had been recommended as the sharpest legal mind in the field of international law, but Dan was experiencing doubts. "The Ruskies are also claiming that you have endangered the entire world by altering the course of the asteroid so that it might hit the Earth."
"Absolute bull,"
Dan stopped himself short. "Nonsense. The asteroid will go into orbit around the Earth. It won't get any closer than the moon does." "Hmm." Sir Edmund looked unconvinced. "Any competent astronomer can make the necessary observations and testify."
"Perhaps.
If the Ruskies don't alter the confounded rock's trajectory." Dan felt his brows hike upward. "Do you think they'd do that?
To beat you in the world court? Are you serious?"
Suddenly, Dan liked this rat-faced Englishman. He laughed. "It's a good thing I've got a few honest astronomers keeping track of the asteroid."
"Yes, quite. They're not all Americans, I trust."
Two from the University of Caracas, one from the International Observatory in Peru, a married couple at the Pic du Midi in the Pyrenees, and the entire Junior Amateur Astronomers League of Japan. Is that good enough? Sir Edmund smiled back at him.
"Sufficient, sufficient."
They resumed their walk toward the Parliament buildings. The two men following them immediately lost interest in the Nepalese bracelets.
"Tell me frankly," Sir Edmund said, his voice lowered almost to a whisper, "did you actually do it?"
"Do what?" Dan asked innocently. Sir Edmund glanced around at the sparse pedestrian traffic.
"No one has a recording device here. There's no need to be reticent."
"Did you really lead that rescue mission?" Dan smiled tightly at him. "Sir Edmund, you're a lawyer. Astro Manufacturing Corporation has retained your services to represent us at the World Court against the Soviet Union's claim that the asteroid and its samples belong to the peoples of the world, which means effectively to Soviet Russia."
"Yes, but..."
"The Soviet Union has protested to the government of Venezuela that I personally invaded the Soviet base on the moon, threatened the lives of Soviet citizens, and abducted 8 Astro employees from Soviet custody."
"Did you or didn't you?"
Dan hesitated, then said, "Somebody did. And whoever it was deserves my unending gratitude. Those 8 employees were returned to Nueva Venezuela unharmed. If the Russians want them back, they're going to have to extradite them from Venezuela. I have another set of lawyers fighting that."
"But did you personally..."
"What difference does it make?" Dan asked.
"Well, I'd like to know just what kind of a client I'm dealing with."
"Your client is a corporation," Dan replied. "A large, multinational, soulless corporation. I just happen to be the man who sits at the top of the machine." Sir Edmund chuckled.
"Very well, Mr. Randolph. Have it your own way. Perhaps one day, after this untidiness is all cleared up, you'll trust me enough to tell me what really happened up there."
They were approaching Westminster Pier. The pedestrian traffic here was thicker, brisker. Men with briefcases and women carrying big shoulder bags strode purposefully. The squatting beggars were scarcer, and a tall, stern-faced Bobby paced slowly along in the opposite direction, hands clasped behind his back. The two men following Dan and Sir Edmund quickened their pace and closed the gap behind them. Dan was asking,
"How long will it take the World Court to hear our case?" "Oh, several months at least. The Ruskies are laying on heavy pressure to get it on the court calendar quickly, but the..."
The two men pushed between them, muttering a "pardon me, please," as they almost knocked Sir Edmund off his feet. Dan staggered a few steps backward.
"Of all the cheeky bastards," Sir Edmund grumbled.
"Just like New York," Dan said. Briefly, he thought about hailing the two men and dressing them down, but they were weaving fast through the crowd, almost running.
"They must be late for an appointment," Dan said, as much to himself as to Sir Edmund. The Englishman squinted up at Big Ben, its tower standing tall.